May it please the Court, my name is Michael Brunton and I represent the certified class of plaintiffs, including the class representative Kelly Bryan. This is an appeal from an order granting defendant's motion for summary judgment and denying plaintiff's motion for summary judgment. The class of plaintiffs were 54 employees of Extra Corporation, the defendant in this case. They were terminated in December 1999 when Extra entered into an outsourcing agreement with ContainerPort. ContainerPort came into Extra's facilities and took over the employment of the plaintiffs. Their jobs were changed, their benefits were changed. Extra still owned the plant. This was not a merger. This was not a sale of assets. It was an outsourcing agreement. Extra admits that these employees were terminated. Prior to the termination, Extra had an ongoing practice and procedure to pay severance benefits to workers who had been terminated or who had their job eliminated.
Do you have any instances in which Extra did this in circumstances where the employee continued on in some sort of comparable employment? In other words, in your own case, the one man who was not picked up by the new company did get the severance benefits, and Extra argues that their practice was indeed quite consistent, and that when somebody such as your client wound up with the same job in the same place, maybe with a slightly different package of benefits, but roughly the same, they, on a case-by-case basis, did not pay these benefits.
And there was no other instance where Extra,
no other instance. Okay.
Where Extra had a similar situation.
But all of your examples are cases where people really did stop working. They didn't start working in another job that Extra had arranged for them.
That's correct. And the term Extra had arranged for them is, this is an outsourcing agreement, and several of the plaintiffs have already lost their jobs.
But weren't they, were they tenured employees at Extra, or were they employees at will?
They were employees at will, but they did have the severance benefit package. So had their jobs been eliminated, like in the Kansas City plant closing, or the Memphis plant closing, or the reorganization that they had in 1999, they would have gotten the severance benefit package like Extra had paid the other workers.
Is there no severance benefit package at the new employer?
No. It's a vesting in program, meaning that, for instance, Kelly Bryans, who would have 30-plus years with Extra, now only has 1 or 2 years since he's been working for ContainerPort. Mm-hmm. So he is not fully vested in the new severance program. He lost the 30 years that he had. That did not go on into ContainerPort. Was not incorporated with ContainerPort.
That's a different kind of benefit than severance, right?
He did not get his vesting in a lot of different benefits, including separation. ContainerPort does have a separation benefit program, but they start anew. They start as new employees. 1 to 2 years that they've been working there, they only get credit for those 2 years. The 30 years that Kelly Bryan did not carry over in determining separation benefits for ContainerPort. That was not included in the contract between Extra and ContainerPort. They did not carry that time over.
I don't have a clear idea of what you think is the plan or the plan document.
There are two written plan documents. One is the 1993 plan, which states, the company will develop and implement an appropriate separation program if business and economic conditions necessitate a reduction in force.
I don't see how that can create enforceable benefits. It doesn't say what the program will be.
Right, and under the Bidlock case, it was stated there that language of an agreement would govern unless the parties could show that extrinsic evidence was necessary to show either, one, a written contract that appeared to be clear was actually ambiguous, number two, the term or terms in the contract were ambiguous, or number three, there was some yawning void that cries out for an implied term. Well, this clearly is. It states that we will develop.
No. This is not a missing term. There's no program. There's no specification of anything.
And
the issue in Bidlock was just, the duration of the of the benefits, but here, how would anybody know what entitlements the workers had when all the company says is it's going to develop an appropriate program?
An ongoing practice or procedure can become binding on the employer to create obligations.
How? It's so vague. How? You mean just because they're doing something, that creates an obligation on them to continue doing it?
The standard, as stated in the Sandstrom James Diadak case, was that if the plan is a reality.
That's just a lot of verbiage. How does one know whether a practice that a company has been undertaking, suppose it's been giving people severance pay, but there's no document which requires that, and the only document is this, you know, saying it says we will develop a severance plan, but we haven't. But meanwhile, they have been, in fact, paying severance pay. They have been giving severance pay. Now, what is it that's necessary for that practice to become binding on the company?
Well, first of all, there was a subsequent written document, and that's what I've termed as the Apollo Memorandum. In 1998, Extra was attempting to merger with Apollo. This merger eventually
fell. Well, you're not answering my question. Forget the extra documents. Under what circumstances, because you're insisting, and it's correct, there is case law, the fact you don't have to have a written plan, but under what conditions does a practice become a plan that creates a duty?
Okay. Whether from the surrounding circumstances.
I know, that's just words, but what do you mean concretely? Suppose a firm, as in my example, has been paying severance pay, but there's no document that reflects any duty to pay. It's just been doing it. So does that create an obligation to continue doing it?
I believe so, and I believe that.
Well, I don't get that, because that just says that they better not start doing anything, because as soon as they start doing anything, they become obligated to continue indefinitely.
Well, as long as it doesn't modify the written agreement, I would agree with you.
The issue isn't modification. The issue is whether just doing something somehow creates an obligation to continue doing it, which seems to be your position.
Yes. And in this case, they've used the same formula each time, which was 1 week pay for every year of service, 1.5 week pay for every $10,000 of salary at the time of termination.
But you have admitted that they never did it, perhaps because it had never come up, perhaps for other reasons, but they had never done it in the set of circumstances here presented where somebody moved over to a different job. They'd only done it when there was real termination. And I see you're running into your rebuttal time, but I'm also concerned about the way your argument plays out given the shift in language from the 92 plan to the 93 plan. So you might just say a word about that.
The 92 plan specifically stated the details of the formula.
Right, which they delete for the plan that you agree is the controlling one here.
And in 93, they merely state we will develop and implement a plan, and they did continue on with the standard formula that was stated in the 92 plan. And so there was really no change in essence. They came out with an Apollo memorandum in 98.
Well, that was with this other merger. I think that's of limited utility since it was with a merger that didn't happen.
I think this case is important for a couple reasons, because first, it can define when an ongoing practice and procedure can be provided as extrinsic evidence to a written agreement when the written agreement has a lot of ambiguities and is basically does not state what the plan will be, and there's no modification by the ongoing program to the written agreement. Second of all, what happens when a subsequent document comes out and it does not modify the written agreement, the subsequent document being the Apollo Memorandum? It states we will pay benefits pursuant to the standard formula, which was used by executives and officers. They called it the standard formula in internal memorandums. They actually had an Excel program on their computer system that made this standard program applicable for terminations, and they were running it the year prior to to Extra's terminations of the employees, and they actually ran it 1 week before the termination. So we've actually got an Excel sheet listing what the severance benefits would be for these 54 employees 1 week before they were terminated. What's then also important
okay,
here...
Okay, thank you. Your time is expired.
Thank you.
Mr. Ulrich?
May it please the court, Mr. Brunson, judges. My name is Alan Ulrich. I'm here on behalf of the defendants. I don't think this case, at least my portion of the argument, will take as long as the time allotted by the court. I think I just want to cover a couple of salient points that will show that the district court was correct. The issue in this case is whether severance benefits should be given to the plaintiffs, the class. And here are some facts. They were never unemployed. They lost no income. They had the same jobs, and they continued in the same jobs. The next day, they went to work for Container Port Corporation.
But they were terminated, though, by Extra. You weren't carrying them as employees. You had no further obligations to them as your employees. They weren't on your payroll anymore.
They were terminated as Extra employees.
That's correct. That's what I'm saying. As from Extra's point of view, these people were terminated. Now, happily for them, they wound up with another job.
As negotiated by Extra.
But in fact, well, I mean, the best Extra, of course, could negotiate for them was that the new company would consider them. If the new company had thought half of them were unqualified, it didn't have to hire that half, I assume.
That's correct, Judge. And in fact, they did hire them, all except one. They kind of hired 53 out of 54.
Right, but that's hindsight. I mean, in fact, they were terminated by Extra, and they had an opportunity to apply for a new job.
But that, yes, ma'am. That doesn't, but that I don't believe triggers anything in the employee handbook with regard to any severance benefits. These individuals received a 3% pay increase. Extra negotiated and paid over $225,000 to these people, 6 weeks additional pay for them to stay on for at least a year with the new employer. So these individuals did not suffer in any way. What is the purpose of severance? As they said in the Sly case, it's generally intended to get people over a period of unemployment. It's generally intended to give people an opportunity to adjust after a layoff. To award severance benefits in this instance is a windfall, which is not what the intent of severance benefits is under ERISA or under ERISA plans.
Well, it depends on the language of the plan, does it not? We have a case where a plan had somewhat different language from yours, the ANSET case, where apparently that employer conceived of severance benefits more broadly than you have. Don't we just have to look at each plan?
I think you do, Your Honor, but in that plan, in that case, it was clear that a termination entitled individuals to severance. In this case, we're talking about a reduction in force which never took place. So not only did
I don't find that as a useful distinction. The plan in ANSTED didn't care if the people picked up a new job or not. It just said if you lose your job, which you've just agreed that these people did it extra, for any reason other than for cause or a voluntary separation, then you get the severance payment. Well, that's straightforward. It's clear. Your language in the 93 plan is quite different, but I'm concerned about overstating this. I would think under ERISA it depends on what kind of a plan the employer wanted to write.
You're correct. In the ANSTED case, if you were terminated, you got severance.
And the whole point of the employer's appeal in that case was that these people, in fact, just like your people, immediately continued working for the new entity.
In this case, though, as you said, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
In this case, Judge, the language of the plan for Extra was different. It did not trigger severance upon termination, and therefore the language of the two plans, as you suggest, was different. And if we look at the language in the Extra plan, it would not entitle people to severance as the plan did in the ANSTED case. That is our position because of the difference in the language. And Extra is allowed under ERISA the opportunity, the right, to use its discretion in what it will do with regard to severance benefits. We take the position in this case that nothing was triggered that would entitle these people to severance benefits.
Would that have only been, say, a reduction in force under the plan?
A reduction in force, Judge, still under the plan language, it could have been discretionary as to what type of severance Extra would have given these people, but clearly that would have been a different situation, a reduction in force, than what took place here. There was no reduction.
No, I'm just looking at it from the standpoint of what the plan would have provided. I know it's hypothetical, but suppose what's it called, Container?
Container Port Corporation.
Suppose they'd only hired, just by virtue of the fact that they were more efficient or something, they only hired two-thirds. Would that have been a reduction in force, so to speak?
If they had only hired two-thirds, then I think the question that comes up, what happens to those additional people? But, as you suggest, but under the language of the plan here that Extra had, it would not have had to pay those people a severance package, but it certainly could have.
Yeah, okay.
But it's discretionary.
Right.
So.
Well, you're really saying there isn't a plan, aren't you?
Well, Judge, there is a plan because obviously under ERISA we have a welfare package here. We have health benefits.
I know there's a plan, but I thought your argument was the plan didn't include severance benefits because you hadn't yet formulated a program.
That's correct, and as I said to Judge Mannion, we could have awarded severance benefits in the hypothetical that he raises, but it wasn't required. It wasn't mandated by the plan as set forth in our employee handbook, Judge.
Well, you in fact did for the one man who was not picked up by Container. Is that correct?
We did give severance benefits to that one man, Judge. That's correct. And we also gave 6 weeks additional pay to those who stayed on and worked for the successor corporation, even though we weren't required to. And there was nothing in the plan that said that we should, but we did.
Mm-hmm. You don't have a separate trust or anything, a separate welfare trust. It's just the company pays these benefits.
That's correct, Judge. Yes, sir. That's correct. So I think the language of the plan is clear that we had the discretionary right to do as we did. But more importantly, I think whether you take a de novo standard or an arbitrary and capricious standard, I believe that the trial court was correct in awarding summary judgment to the defendants. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Allwell. Well, Mr. Brunson, we'll give you another minute if you anything more?
Thank you for the additional time. The Apollo memo states, which is 1998, states that we'll give these benefits pursuant to the standard formula, which they've admitted there is a standard formula. The executive said that there was a standard formula in internal memorandums. They said, too, unless there is a permanent comparable position with an affiliated company. That was the language used in the Apollo memo. Now, in this Doe versus Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Wisconsin case, which was an ERISA action for psychiatric care under the plan, subsequent correspondents were able to modify the terms of a written plan. In this case, we're not saying that there is any modification by the Apollo memo.
I understand the Apollo memo is a plan. I thought the Apollo memo was designed for a specific proposed acquisition, not anything general.
The Apollo memo was distributed.
No, I know it was distributed, but it was for this Apollo transaction. It wasn't for anything to do with Container.
And it
I don't see it as a plan document.
And it does not state anything in that document limiting it only to the merger. And it could.
No, but it's about wasn't it designed for a specific transaction that Extra was contemplating?
That's Extra's take on it. That's not the employee's take on it.
What does the word Apollo refer to?
Apollo was the company that was going to merge.
Right, and you call it the Apollo memo. So it was a plan designed for a specific transaction, an acquisition of some sort by Apollo. It wasn't general, was it?
Well, it confirmed, reaffirmed the understanding of all the employees of what the benefit package was, because it stated the formula that was going to be applied in that merger, and there was nothing stating that we're only using it for this merger and nothing else.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel.
Thank you.
Next case for argument, May Department Stores versus